From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you still practice the religion of your childhood? If you don't, you're not alone. Almost half of all Americans say they have changed religions at least once. Questioning inherited wisdom comes easy to some of us. Novelist Philip Pullman is one of England's best-known atheists. His latest book questions the very origins of Christianity.
Suppose that Jesus was being tempted not by given authority over the whole world as he is in the Gospels by Satan, but by being told about a church. The one thing Jesus did not want, it seems to me, was a church.
For other people, losing their religion is often a difficult, even a dramatic, personal struggle. That can be especially true for someone who spent his childhood immersed in a fundamentalist religious world.
Armageddon is coming at any moment. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you got a hand stamp into paradise. The belief system was really, really hard to shake, and I've been through a lot of therapy. It takes a while to just shake that little inner, the inner Jehovah.
In this hour, why some people lose their faith. We'll hear from this former Jehovah's Witness and from Rhoda Jensen, author of the best-selling memoir Mennonite in a Little Black Dress. But first, the Somali-born activist Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Though she was raised a devout Muslim, Hirsi Ali later sought asylum in the Netherlands and was elected to the Dutch parliament. Eventually, she renounced Islam and turned into an outspoken atheist. Hirsi Ali became widely known when her filmmaker partner Theo van Gogh was murdered in Amsterdam after they made a film that blasted Islam's treatment of women. She herself received death threats and spent months in hiding. After returning to public life, Hirsi Ali wrote the best-selling memoir Infidel. And now she's written another book called Nomad, which argues that fundamentalist Islam poses a serious threat to the West. Hirsi Ali told Anne Strangechamps that her fierce criticism of religion grew out of her own mind-bending journey.
It's a journey that takes me from being a believer in what my father and mother teach me is the difference between right and wrong. And the morality for that was derived from Islam. The first 22 years of my life, I used the Quran and Muhammad as a moral compass. And gradually, I found myself shifting, drifting away to something else, to liberalism, individual rights, freedoms, the idea that I didn't need one book to take answers from, but that I could use my reason to distinguish between right and wrong. That is the mental journey.
Could you tell me something about your own family upbringing? I mean, how would you describe the way your parents raised you and your siblings?
I have an idea that we came as children to my parents as accidents. I say that only in retrospect and comparing them to Western parents who go about planning and planning and planning when the first child comes, when the second child comes, etc. My mother, after she married my father, was pregnant every year, every other year. She lost many of those pregnancies and some of the children didn't make it to adulthood. Three of us did. And of those three of us who did it, we were continuously told by my grandmother that we have to be loyal to the bloodline. She tried to teach us that, to learn the bloodline by heart, but also to be loyal to them. And her definition of loyalty was, given the fact that I was a girl, my loyalty was to preserve and conserve and guard my chastity. And it seemed as if to my grandmother the only goal was, by the time I reached maturity, which in her vision is 15 years of age, I would then have to find the right husband. And that husband would protect me, but all I had to do was submit to him. And the husband and I would produce children for the clan. So our loyalty, our life was completely devoted to carrying the bloodline one generation further. Now, how do you keep individuals behaving themselves? Most of that was enforced with Islamic rule. And the question that was used to blackmail us from day to day was, when you are standing in front of your God in the hereafter, would you like to be thrown into permanent hell or into permanent heaven? And that is a very, very compelling deterrent from sin. And sin, as I later came to understand it, was almost everything that Western society stood for, cherished, and invested in.
So you're describing an upbringing which was, in many ways, a kind of tribal upbringing. The primary loyalty was to your bloodline, to your clan.
I got into, when I was in the Netherlands, the confusion of if I want to stay loyal to the bloodline, I can't integrate into Dutch society, be individualized, follow Dutch language classes, educate myself, make my own money and save it. Every activity that I did to integrate into Dutch society, almost every single activity entailed that I was somehow directly or indirectly betraying the blood clan and my religion. As I spent more time in Holland and got acquainted with other Muslims from other countries like Morocco, like Turkey, like Afghanistan, Iraq, Azerbaijan, I realized that we were all facing the same dilemma.
But there are plenty of Muslim women in the U.S. who have made that transition, who are now professional women, teachers, lawyers, doctors, magazine editors, scientists, and who also are observant Muslims.
Oh, that's not what I mean. It is very much possible to leave a chaotic place, find an occupation in the West, follow it through and enjoy it. Problems only arise if the bloodline or the faith appeal to you to do something that in your conscience and in the new society that you're serving contradicts one another. I think the latest and most famous example is the young man who tried to blow up Times Square. He came on a student visa in search of the American dream. He demonstrated that he was capable of getting into university and passing his exams. He married an American woman. But when the forces of the bloodline and Islamism appealed to him, that got him into a state of confusion. And for him to get out of that state of confusion, out of that state of dissonance, he heeded what the Prophet Muhammad instructs him to do, at least what the jihadists tell him that they do, and gave up his job, took his wife and children to Pakistan, went to Pakistan to train for all kinds of terrorist activities, and in fact went on to carry out a terrorist activity. Now, I'm not saying he is the average Muslim, but I'm saying for those individuals who are very conscientious like he is, when they're confronted with predicaments like, where do I belong? Am I a citizen or am I a Muslim first?
Surely there's also more than one kind of Islam. I mean, aren't there plenty of Muslims who consider the Quran's teachings to be about peace and tolerance and who regard the teachings of Islamist groups to be a perversion of their religion?
The overwhelming majority of Muslims have not read the Quran. If they have, they've read it in Arabic, which is not their first language. Most Muslims live in despotic nations. The average Muslim's day-to-day life is one that is made up of how do I survive? But there is an activism financed by countries like Saudi Arabia and wealthy individuals living in Saudi Arabia who made money out of oil, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates. When this movement goes from house to house, sets up websites, has sermons going up from mosque to mosque, even builds mosques, sets up Muslim centers targeting Muslim individuals, what we see is a Muslim individual who was initially not in the least interested in any kind of conflict between his religion and his daily life, but is put in that position because the fundamentalist is asking questions like, are you a true Muslim? And how do I know? And where do you belong? When that occurs, and it is happening to many, many Muslims, it's very important when you are challenged with, but it's in the Quran, do you truly believe in the Quran? Do you truly want to follow the instructions of Prophet Muhammad to say, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know that it's in the Quran, but I refuse to follow it. And it's that last part that most Muslims feel slightly weak and get weak-kneed and get confused and get recruited into the wrong side of things.
One of the things you suggest doing is you suggest that Christian churches reach out to Muslims to offer the Christian God as a substitute for Allah, and that Muslims consider converting to Christianity. That's a fairly controversial suggestion.
Readers of Infidel wrote back to me who resisted the siren song of the jihadists and said, I don't want it. They went to the Quran and checked it out. The jihadist was right. The instructions were in there. Muhammad did a series of things for jihad and has a series of demands. They were there. What these individuals, when they write to me, tell me is, it's fine. I've made up my mind about Islam. I don't want to be a Muslim, but Ayan, I also don't want to be like you. I don't want to be an atheist. I just don't want to. I believe that there is a force out there, a God, and many of them convert to Christianity. And the Christianity that they convert to, by the way, they're trying to appeal to me to also convert to Christianity, is it's a force for goodness. In the churches that these people go to, they don't find that there is discrimination of women or of gay people. They're not intolerant. So it is a modern, evolved, reformed Christianity that is tolerant, that is not hostile to science, but then at the same time gives ex-Muslims a spiritual crutch that they can lean on.
What about the option that does speak to a lot of Christians and Jews, or people who were brought up Christian or Jewish, who are not comfortable practicing the religion anymore? They often refer to themselves as culturally Jewish or culturally Christian. Could you be a cultural Muslim but not a religiously observant practicing Muslim?
All my Muslim friends are culturally Muslim. We sit on the ground, we make sweets, we feed each other a lot of food. It's just a sense of, oh yeah, we share familiar things from our past and the past of our parents and our grandparents. That's not the Islam that I'm against. The Islam that I'm against is the political side of Islam, the activist side. Distance yourself from the infidel, conquer non-Muslim countries, destroy Israel. America is the big Satan. Women must be covered. Gays must be thrown off the toilet. That form of intolerance is something that the Muslims that I associate with do not have. If it's about food and about art, if that's culturally Muslim, I have absolutely no problem with it. And there are many, many, many cultural. In fact, I think most Muslims are culturally Muslim, except that when these radical agents of Islam go to them and tell them, you're not a proper Muslim. And I feel that when you get an accusation like that, you should be immunized against it. You should be able to have to respond mentally in a strong way to tell that agent, I know scripture, I know what Muhammad said, and yet I think you should go away.
Ayan Hirsi Ali is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. In 2007, she established the AHA Foundation to protect the rights of women in the West against militant Islam. Her latest book is called Nomad, From Islam to America, a personal journey through the clash of civilizations. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Questioning religion is a topic close to Philip Pullman's heart. One of England's most famous atheists, he's described his best-selling fantasy novels The Golden Compass and The Amber Spyglass as his response to C.S. Lewis's overtly Christian Chronicles of Narnia. Now for his latest novel, Pullman has taken on an even more loaded subject, the story of Jesus. The book is called The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. Steve Paulson asked Philip Pullman about the idea behind his novel and his own intriguing views on what it means to be religious.
I've heard that the origins of this book go back to a question posed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Is that true?
That's true, yes. About 7 years ago now, the National Theatre in London was presenting a production of a play based on my trilogy, His Dark Materials, which criticizes organized religion. Anyway, one day the Archbishop of Canterbury came to see the play, and he was spotted in the audience by some schoolchildren who went up to him at the interval and said, "Oh, Archbishop, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be watching this. This is against the church." And he said to them, "Well, actually, I'm quite enjoying it." And word of this got back to the director of the theatre, Nicholas Heitner, and he thought it would be a good idea to invite the Archbishop and me to have a conversation on the stage and see if we could explore this difference between what we felt and what we believed. So we did this, and I enjoyed it very much. And in the course of it, the Archbishop asked me a question that I hadn't been asked before. He said, "Look, you've written this book which is critical of the organized church and religion and so on, but you don't mention Jesus. Now, why have you left Jesus out?" I had to say, "Well, you're right, I have done, and I didn't really mean to do that, but since you pointed it out, maybe I'd better make up for that by writing a book about Jesus." And so here it is, 7 years later.
Now, you are one of England's best-known atheists, and you were obviously skeptical of much of the biblical story about the origins of Christianity, especially the stories of miracles. But I have to say, this is a very admiring portrait of Jesus himself.
Well, I'm not a Christian, but I wouldn't mind being called a Jesusite. Jesus is one of the most extraordinary and admirable human beings who ever lived. And I stress human beings because, of course, I don't believe he was the Son of God. I don't believe any of the supernatural stuff. And I was struck again as I read the Gospels and the epistles, indeed, of Paul to prepare for this, struck again by what an extraordinary man he was and what a great gift he had, a gift for storytelling such as few people have ever had.
So what's your understanding of the historical Jesus? What kind of man do you think he was?
I think he was one of what were probably quite a number of wandering preachers, healers, prophets, holy men, some of them genuinely inspired, some of them mad, some of them con men, some of them real doers of good, wandering the roads of that part of the world we call Palestine during the Roman occupation. And he was one, as I say, of a great number of wandering preachers. He was unusual in his particular gifts, in those gifts, as I've described them, of storytelling and phrase-making, and also unusual in that the fact of his death coming at a particular time in the history of the Jews, at a particular time in the course of his own life, allowed his followers to begin to believe that he had come to life again.
So what you've done in your novel is you have created Jesus and Christ as twin brothers, and as you say in your title, the good man Jesus and the scoundrel Christ. What makes Christ a scoundrel?
Once I thought of these two brothers, I began to speculate about them and hear them speaking to me in my mind and speaking to each other, and I watched them going about in my mind's eye, as you do when you're writing a novel. And they seemed to me to have different characters. Jesus was strong and certain and charismatic and full of authority and quick imagination and wonderful personal authority. He could command a crowd. He could almost hypnotize people into believing they were well again. He was a figure of great personal magnetism. The Christ, I imagined, was a different figure, withdrawn, introverted, quiet, reflective, an observer rather than an actor, than a participant. And this difference grew in my mind. And little by little, I began to see that the Christ I was imagining was the one who was preoccupied with telling the stories about Jesus and in time actually changing them, making them fit more into what was developing in his mind and in the mind of other people as the church that was to come. He was a recorder of history, not a maker of history.
Although in your story, he is also the stand-in for certain other biblical characters. For instance, when Jesus is in the desert, Christ is the one who urges him to perform miracles to show his followers that the kingdom of God is really coming. And then later,
that's right, yeah.
Christ is the Judas figure who actually betrays Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane.
This is where it got very interesting for me, because allowing Christ to have these two roles, the role of Satan tempting Jesus in the wilderness, and later the role of Judas, meant that I could speculate about what it was that was going on, really. Now, suppose that Jesus was being tempted not by given authority over the whole world, as he is in the Gospels, by Satan, but by being told about a church, an organization that would celebrate his name and lead people to God and so on. And eventually all the princes of the world would bow down before it, and it would have beautiful palaces and marble churches and marble courts and so on. And Jesus, of course, rejects this out of hand. The one thing Jesus did not want, it seems to me, was a church. And then later on in the temptation scene, I have Christ beginning to realize that this is going to be a tragedy. No good is going to come of this. Another figure came into the story at this point, and this is a figure I call the stranger. From time to time, the Christ figure in the book is visited by a stranger who never tells us or Christ his name, and who Christ thinks at first is a priest, and then is a Gentile philosopher, and then later on even an angel. And this stranger begins to talk to him and beguile Christ with a vision of what the church might be. And he says, you know, what Jesus says is all very well, but human beings aren't like that. We can't live as if, you know, there was to be no tomorrow, and we can't live as Jesus wants us to live. He's asking too much of human beings. They need a church. They don't need him. They need a church. And so he begins to tempt Christ to move away from the vision of Jesus and to another vision entirely.
Well, I'm wondering if you could read a passage that maybe from one of these scenes, these interactions between Christ and the stranger, because one of the points that the stranger keeps making is that there's a difference between truth and history, and Christ is on the side of truth.
That's right. This is the stranger speaking to Christ. You told him, you told Jesus, that is, you told him that people needed miracles and signs. You told him of the importance of dramatic events in persuading them to believe. He didn't listen because he thought that the kingdom was coming so soon that no persuasion would be necessary. And again, you urged him to accept the existence of what we have agreed to call the church. He scoffed at the idea, but he was wrong, and you were right. Without miracles, without a church, without a scripture, the power of his words and his deeds will be like water poured into the sand. It dampens the sand for a moment, and then the sun comes and dries it, and after a moment there's no sign that it's ever been there. Even the history that you began to write so meticulously, with such diligence and care for the truth, even that will be scattered like dry leaves and forgotten. In another generation, the name of Jesus will mean nothing, and neither will the name Christ. How many healers and exorcists and preachers are there walking the roads of Palestine? Dozens and dozens. Everyone will be forgotten, and so will Jesus, unless... But the kingdom, said Christ, the kingdom will come. No, said the angel, there will be no kingdom in this world. You were right about that as well. I never denied the kingdom. You did. When you described the church, you spoke as if the kingdom would not come about without it. And you were right. No, no, said Christ. I said that if God wanted to, he could bring the kingdom about just by lifting a finger. But God does not want to. God wants the church to be an image of the kingdom. Perfection does not belong here. We can only have an image of perfection. Jesus, in his purity, is asking too much of people. We know they're not perfect as he wishes them to be. We have to adjust ourselves to what they are. You see, the true kingdom would blind human beings like the sun, but they need an image of it all the same. And that is what the church will be. My dear Christ, the stranger went on, leaning forward, human life is difficult. There are profundities and compromises and mysteries that look to the innocent eye like betrayal. Let the wise men of the church bear those burdens, because there are plenty of other burdens for the faithful to carry.
Oh, that is good. Thank you very much. So Christ becomes the figure who chronicles and embellishes the stories about Jesus and makes up a bunch of stuff, including the one who stages the resurrection after Jesus dies, essentially to create a story for the Christians to come.
Well, when you've got twins in a story, there must be a point at which one is mistaken for the other.
I have to say, this is a very cynical retelling of the resurrection, and from a Christian perspective, I would think a rather offensive rendition.
It may be offensive, but as I said to someone in the audience who asked me this question when I launched this book, no one has to read this book, no one has to pick it up, and if they read it, they don't have to like it, and if they read it and they dislike it, they don't have to be quiet about it. They can write to me, and they can write to the publisher, and they can write to the newspapers, and they can write their own version. But that's where their rights stop. You can't expect to go through all your life without being offended. No one has the right to live without being offended. And no one has the right to stop me from publishing this book.
So what ultimately do you hope to come from this? I mean, you're a novelist, of course, not the great guru who's going to propound on what everyone should say about religion. But, I mean, what are you hoping in terms of how people should think about religion? Are you suggesting that people need to reconfigure the nature of their faith, or are you saying that people should just throw it out altogether?
No, I'm not scornful of people who are religious. I'm not scornful of religion. It's something that has existed in every human society we know about, and it's an impulse that every human being has in one way or another. I call myself a religious person, although I don't believe in God.
Why do you call yourself a religious person?
Because the religious questions, which is what I call questions of purposes and origins. Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? That sort of thing. And what must we do to be good? And why do we feel that good is better than evil? And why should we do good at all if there's no one to punish us? Questions like that are religious questions, and I ask them all the time. But I don't believe there's a supernatural answer. That's the difference.
That's Philip Pullman talking with Steve Paulson from the BBC studio in Oxford, England. Pullman's novel is called The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. Some people have made careers out of questioning religion. But what happens when an entire society questions it? Or just stops caring about it? Phil Zuckerman is a sociologist who spent a year in Scandinavia interviewing nearly 150 Danes and Swedes about their theological beliefs. In his book, Society Without God, Zuckerman says that while a vast majority of Americans believe in God, most Scandinavians are, by contrast, quite happy to forget about religion.
If asked directly, a majority will say they do believe in God, although it's markedly lower than here. So in Sweden, for example, it can hover around 50%. I've even seen lower. Danes, it's a bit higher. Around 60% of Danes will say they believe in God. However, when you probe that and ask them, well, what do you mean by believe in God? The true sort of secular soul emerges. To them, God is an very abstract, very fuzzy thing out there that they just don't really think too much about. In fact, there are some surveys where they ask people, you know, how important is God in your life on a scale of 1 to 10? And in that category, the Danes come, I believe, you know, last in the world, where only about 20% place any importance on God in their life.
Well, that really sets the stage, the ground level for the study that you did. But it's fascinating to an American because I think here most people, if asked, would say that if you don't have a general belief in God, you can't have a moral society.
That was one of the biggies that I wanted to explore, and one of the real passions underlying why I took on this project and why I wrote this book. I was really writing it for an American audience, and specifically for those among us who sort of believe that, well, you know, you have to have God at the center of your life. God has to be a significant part of any culture, or else that culture will be immoral, chaotic. And that's just simply incorrect. You know, it's a sociological assertion in a way. I mean, if you say, okay, you know, we need to have a strong faith and belief in God, and this will result in a moral society, well, that's something we can go look at. We can go check it out. We can, quote unquote, test it. But the fact of the world today is that in places like Scandinavia and elsewhere where religion is marginal, these societies are still quite moral, quite ethical, especially when compared to very religious societies such as our own.
What about specific issues, though? There are things that I think everyone would recognize as events in our lives that cause us perhaps to turn to religion. There was a conversation you had with Jens. You had a long conversation with him. And his wife died of cancer when she was, what, 40 years old? And they had a small child at the time. Now, you would think here in America that would cause Jens to question life, to question fairness, to rail, to or perhaps to pray to God for guidance.
Exactly. And quite the opposite. He simply had a sort of almost, I don't know, Zen acceptance of, you know, this happened. It was unfortunate. Here I am, you know, my daughter's 4 years old and her mother's dying of cancer. And it was hard, but he sought help with friends and family, and even I think a little bit the church, if I recall. And he did tell his daughter, well, mom's in the clouds or in heaven, because he felt like she needed to hear that at such a young age. But I think the Scandinavians have it right in a sense that I do think religion provides a lot of things that humans do need. I think we like community. We need social support. We need life rituals, cycles of life rituals. We need celebrations, songs, and all those things they still have in abundance. And I think that's a really important lesson that a lot of the new atheists, I think, don't like to talk about. They just want to sort of slam the theology without recognizing the other good that comes with religious culture and religious life.
There is, in fact, a fairly strong tradition of Christianity in Scandinavia, specifically a strong Lutheran tradition. And people will baptize their children and have them go through confirmation, and they marry in the church. But even then, they don't see it as essentially religious in nature.
I would say that's correct. The vast majority will baptize their children. Many of those children will grow up to get confirmed around age 14. Most of Scandinavians like to get married in a church and buried in a church, but it's certainly not for God. And I ask this specifically of people who baptize their kids, why did you do this? None of them said it was for God or for Jesus or for saving their children's souls from hell. In fact, Scandinavians have the lowest belief in hell on the planet Earth. So these things are done, I think, for social and communal reasons, and not for, saving our souls from everlasting punishment.
There's a point early in the book when you ask a series of questions. In fact, I think it's right at the beginning of the first chapter. You say, what are societies like when belief in God is minimal, church attendance is drastically low, and religion is a distinctly muted and marginal aspect of everyday life? The answer appears to be, in your mind, strong models of societal health, and that, to an American, is almost anathema.
And you know what's so funny, though? We can see it within our own borders. We can simply look at states that are the most religious in terms of church attendance, Bible study, belief in God, belief in Jesus, and we can see how these states are faring, and we actually see the same correlations. The most religious states in our own country have the highest murder rates, the highest drunk driving rates, poverty rates, domestic abuse rates, they're the worst schools, the worst hospitals. Correlation is not causation, but the correlation is so significant, not only internationally, but even within our own country, that, again, the least religious states are and countries are doing quite well, at least according to these standard sociological measures.
Make it personal for me. There was a moment you describe, I think it was just before you were going to leave Denmark. You took a bus ride in the city where you lived. Would you tell us about that?
The bus ride, you know, actually it was my wife that prompted me to write about that. Just one day, it was in the middle of my stay there. I was going to meet someone downtown for an interview. And, you know, Aarhus is a big city. It's the second largest city in Denmark. So it's not some, you know, quiet little hamlet somewhere. And I caught the bus and I'm just looking out the window. And I see all these children on the bus, first of all, coming home from school, unaccompanied. You know, these are young kids that are able to navigate the bus system without a problem, without parents. I see old ladies. The buses are designed so there's certain seats for the older people. There's certain places for them to put their things. And I just looked out the window, and what did I see? These amazing bike lanes that are quite wide and safe. I saw well-groomed parks and women jogging and men jogging. And I saw the ocean looking beautiful and the harbor. And the bus, you know, stopped on time at each station, announced each station, and I got off my bus and I just felt the pleasantness of this city. I walked to my cafe where I was to have an interview, and I thought, my goodness, you know, I wish every American could have taken that bus ride with me. And I wish I could have said, look, these are countries that allow for gay marriage. These are countries that, you know, people are not that religious. The politicians certainly are not religious. These are countries that do not believe in the literal word of the Bible, that do not mandate prayer in school. And look at what a pleasant place it is. Look how it's working. Look at what a modern society can look like. And yeah, that's what I wanted to write about.
Phil Zuckerman is a professor of sociology at Pitzer College. He's the author of several books, including Strife in the Sanctuary, Religious Schism in a Jewish Community. I spoke with him about his latest work, Society Without God, What the Least Religious Nations Can Tell Us About Contentment. What do you think? Does a society need religion to be happy and ethical? You can share your views by sending us an email at our website, ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about losing religion. The decision to turn away from a childhood faith can be difficult, particularly if it means leaving behind your family or community of origin. What happens if you need to go back? When author Rhoda Jansen fell on hard times, she went back to California to live with her Mennonite parents. Jansen wrote about that experience in her touching and funny memoir, Mennonite in a Little Black Dress. As she told Anne Strandchamps, she has many happy memories of her Mennonite childhood. But some things, like her school lunches, were just humiliating.
They were especially richly humiliating.
What was so bad about them?
Well, there was just something about ethnic food, Mennonite food, which was all homemade and all very odorous, all in these terrible leftover containers. In contrast with the lunches of my peers, junk food and ding-dongs and cupcakes and prefab snacks that we weren't allowed to have. It just looked so glorious to me.
And meanwhile, what were you eating?
I was eating things like leftover borscht, and this is a Mennonite Russian soup involving cabbage and beets. It's kind of a scurrilous smell and kind of tepid in a thermos as well. We ate some leftover fritters. We ate things called Rollkuchen and Quarkkuchen. And these are actually delicious foods, but because nobody else had them and because they were a little stinky, I was just really embarrassed.
There must have been times, on the other hand, when you found yourself unexpectedly grateful to be growing up Mennonite.
Oh, yes. I had a teacher in middle high school who wanted us to dance as part of an eighth grade fundraiser. And I wasn't allowed to dance because of the Mennonite sort of traditional injunction against dancing as an unwholesome activity. And my mom asked that I not participate in that. And, oh, man, I thought that I had a free pass on that one.
Well, let's talk about the circumstances that led you to go home again. Your marriage fell apart, and painfully.
I had been married for 15 years when my husband announced that he was leaving me for a guy named Bob, whom he had met on gay.com.
Ouch.
Yeah, ouch.
And he also left you holding the mortgage for an expensive house the two of you had just bought. And then, just a few weeks later, you wound up in a car accident.
He didn't leave me without financial assistance. He pledged, in fact, that he would give me half that mortgage for 3 years. But that was part of the trauma for me, that I wouldn't be able to handle the financial situation on my own. We had only recently moved to a two-salary mortgage lake house. So that was a problem. And then, yes, 6 days later, I was in a car accident. So that was a trauma that I hadn't seen coming, and it sure felt like a literalization of a broken heart.
Was that the point at which you just said, that's it, I'm packing up and going home?
Well, even then I didn't do that. Even then I was thinking, it can't get any worse. But in the next couple of weeks, when I was trying to heal and trying to sort out my life, I had some talks with my department chair at the college where I teach, and so he suggested that I go visit my family. And I thought, you know what, why not? It had been so very long since I had been back to my community of origin, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to do that.
There's a scene in your book when you and your mom and dad are driving, and you stop someplace for a meal, I think a roadside cafe. And
right.
I was thinking, it's the kind of scene as a kid, it might have mortified you. You had a different take on it as an adult.
Well, in that scene, it was actually a funny and odd scene because here I was, you know, recently separated from my husband. And so in that way that newly single people are, I was kind of hyper-conscious of the way men responded to me or failed to respond to me. And there were some young guys sitting across from our booth, and they were kind of checking me out. And then just at that moment, my dad suggested we bow our heads for prayer, and we did. And that scotched their interest. And so right away, I'm like, oh, wow, no. It felt like a sudden revisiting of that embarrassment as a child. But when I actually began listening to the words of my father's prayer, that embarrassment just faded away. And I was so content to be in that moment and in that experience praying with my parents.
Mm-hmm. What else surprised you about being back home, being part of the Mennonite community again?
Well, I was surprised that everybody was so, just across the boards, kind and accepting and open to me.
So there was no sense of, you know, maybe now she'll come to her senses?
You know, I think there probably were conversations like that, but none to my face. A couple of older Mennonites even offered to set me up with their sons and grandsons. That was sweet.
Well, one did, didn't she? Can you describe that scene? You're visiting, I can't remember her name now.
Well, I won't name her name on the radio, but she was a lovely, lovely woman. She was quite old, and she was under the impression that I was much younger than I was, in the same way that, you know, sometimes to people who have reached a certain age, everybody begins to look young. And she was imagining that I might be an appropriate date for her 27-year-old grandson. And I was 44 at the time.
Were you ever tempted to stay?
I was very much tempted by my new understanding of the Mennonite community and my new interest in the faith that they were demonstrating on a daily basis. And because of what I saw in the Mennonite community, I have made some significant changes in my life since then. I have recently married a man of faith. He's not a Mennonite, but there it is. And I have recently, volitionally, gone back to church. I'm now a participating member of a church community.
Are there other aspects of being Mennonite that you decided to reclaim after you went home?
I have always respected and admired the political positions that come with a thoughtful understanding and application of the idea of Jesus' life in the New Testament. So that's something that I have revisited and refreshed in my own life. Beyond things like theology and belief and ideology, simply the values that I see in the Mennonite community. Simplicity, a position against unnecessary consumerism, family values, the celebration of family and community. Those are things that are becoming increasingly important to me.
One of the great pleasures of reading your book is the extremely sympathetic portrait that emerges of your parents. They come across as so real and so kind, so completely accepting, which in some ways goes against the stereotype of members of a conservative religious community.
You know, it does. It does seem to counter those stereotypes. And I myself was guilty of some of those stereotypes of organized religion. I do believe that my parents are extraordinary in the sense that they really do live what they believe. But, you know, since the book has come out, I've received lots of emails from people who know my parents and who want to share stories with me about, for instance, the ways that my parents affected them and reached out to them with support and a lack of judgment and so on. So it's not just me. I think that my parents are really lovely people.
You grew up in a Mennonite community, which has to have meant growing up in a very controlling environment. Your husband, your marriage, seemed on the surface, you know, to be part of this more worldly, more open, more tolerant lifestyle. And yet it turns out your husband was extremely controlling. Are there ways in which you think having grown up Mennonite continues to shape you, to mark you in terms of the kinds of relationships you have, for better or for worse?
For better or for worse, yes. There does seem to be, for instance, an emphasis on passivity. And I won't use the word obedience because nobody ever told me that girls and women should be obedient to men. But we saw modeled in our community adult women who very much put their men's interests and careers ahead of their own. And I think those things do end up having an effect on the women we become as adults. I am reminded of a line from a Faulkner short story. He said, "She clung to that which had robbed her, as people do."
On the other hand, you know, your book has so many hilarious moments. It's awkward family dinners, memories of growing up with an outhouse. I have to say, many families would flinch at the amount of dirty linen you seem to have aired in public. How has your family reacted to your book?
My mom has been unfailingly supportive, and she has just been lovely. My father has expressed support, although I am perfectly aware that this is certainly not the book he would have chosen to write.
Can you still go home again?
I think I can still go home again, yes.
Rhoda Jensen teaches English and writing at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps about her memoir, Mennonite in a Little Black Dress, a memoir of going home. Jehovah's Witnesses are known for proselytizing door-to-door and actively encouraging people to change their beliefs. But even that group sometimes loses its own. Tony Duchesne has written a novel based on his childhood as a Jehovah's Witness. It's rather irreverently called Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. But he told Steve Paulson he didn't write the book to criticize the religion so much as to start a conversation.
The writings of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that I've read tended to be woe-is-me memoirs.
What do you mean, woe-is-me memoirs?
Like, sometimes people will blame, like, their whole existence on being a Jehovah's Witness, you know, where it was obvious there was other dysfunction in their family. So what I wanted to do was just really capture a slice of time and life of a teenager who doesn't even know he's in a belief system.
Let's talk about the main character in your book, your narrator, Gabe, who is a teenager who's obsessed with sex, obsessed with girls, but is terrified to act on his desires because the repercussions would be severe. Was this your experience?
Yeah. Yes, it was. But yeah, just the aching, you know, the pubescent desires and the aching, you know, all of a sudden you feel, you realize you're a sexual being, and inside the Jehovah's Witnesses, you're being told, don't touch that, and that's the double entendre, and, you know, don't go there because that can lead to fornication before marriage, and that could lead to you dying by God's hand at any moment when Armageddon comes. It's very conflicting when you're growing up. You know, it's conflicting anyway as a teenager to turn into a sexual being, but, you know, throw somebody into the world of Jehovah's Witnesses and it becomes a lot more complicated and, you know, more guilt.
So I take it you are no longer a Jehovah's Witness.
You think so?
Or maybe you are and you can just, you know, be kind of an internal critic. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I left over 10 years ago and the belief system was really, really hard to shake. And I've been through a lot of therapy. It takes a while to just shake that little inner Jehovah.
you've mentioned this idea of Armageddon. What exactly is the belief there?
Armageddon is coming at any moment. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you got a hand stamp into paradise. And if you're not a Jehovah's Witness, you better, you know, step up and just look at the Jehovah's Witnesses and go, you know what? You guys are right. I'm really sorry. And then you might have a chance. And 7 billion people will be, you know, killed.
So even if you're a Christian but not a Jehovah's Witness, you'll still be struck down by God.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses just like denounce every other religion. Every other religion is false religion. They are Christendom. They are the enemy.
Now, you have some very funny passages in your book as the Jehovah's Witnesses are driving around, say, a rich neighborhood looking for doors to knock on, and they talk about the houses they're passing and sort of kind of fantasize about actually living in those rich houses once Armageddon happens, because, of course, all those present owners will be gone.
Yes. There's a little passive aggressiveness because, like, maybe the door was slammed on them when, you know, they tried to offer the watchtower in a rich neighborhood. And they're like, wow, you know, cool. We can come and claim this house when Armageddon comes. You know, it's very funny because, you know, now the internet's opened up. So there's people who discuss such things, and Jehovah's Witnesses say, oh, that never happened, but I'm finding that, you know, that story is pretty much universal among the Jehovah's Witnesses, no matter where you were at.
That must have been pretty mortifying for you to go knocking on doors of total strangers trying to convert them.
Sometimes it was, and sometimes it wasn't. It was mortifying when I knew I was in a neighborhood where there was, like, girls or guys from my high school or from my, you know, junior high school. I mean, I was knocking on doors since I was like 4 years old with my father. And my father was adamant about me being with him every Saturday morning. So, yeah, so there was a lot of anxiety involved. And then, You know, there's also some fun parts to it, too. There's a lot of pretty girls who are Jehovah's Witnesses who go preaching, too. And, you know, if you can, like, sit next to them and, you know, just feel you can, like, actually touch their leg in the backseat of a car, you know, when you're that age, that's just bliss when you're in the Jehovah's Witnesses. So
this wasn't just a horrible childhood for you. I mean, there were good things about it, too.
No, and that's what I tried to bring out in the book, because it's like, why do people stay in the Jehovah's Witnesses? And the truth is because it's not all bad. There's the, you know, oozing sexuality of going out preaching with, you know, a teenage girl, but they also have like their own dances and, there's a dance party in the book and, you know, those were a blast. And there's a lot of teenagers, a lot of people your age. You know, there's a camaraderie that, you know, we're all going to make it into the new system and we're fighting the world. You know, we're fighting our worldly tendencies together. So there is a lot of community and a lot of social, like, patting on the back.
Do you think many Jehovah's Witnesses will read your book, maybe under the covers, if nothing else?
That's what I hope for. This book kind of gives me closure to my identity that I don't feel ashamed about anymore. And it was also, it's also a hope that it gives identity to the teenager who comes knocking on your door with a watchtower, where people will go, oh, wait, there is a lot more to this person than some kid who's just trying to convert me. You know, there could be a lot more complicated stuff going on in his head. And hopefully my book brings understanding. And yeah, I hope a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses read it under the covers. I think some will. Then they won't tell anybody and then it'll get tossed into the trash with their Playboys and their hard drives filled with porn.
The other side that doesn't usually get talked about.
Yeah, I tend to be okay talking about stuff that usually shames people. I don't know what. Yeah, I do everything backwards. I think you're supposed to talk to a therapist about this stuff and not tell anyone else. But I'd rather just tell the world, and then, you know, one on one, we'll have polite conversation and not bring such things up.
Tony Duchesne is a writer and radio host who lives in San Francisco. His novel is called Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website at ttbook.org, where you can stream audio or download a podcast. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 822B, Losing Religion. If you'd like to comment on today's show, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook page. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Aaron Kloon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.